Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
It is the Mark Rudin Show on 97.1 FM Talk. I'm Ethan Hannaford, producer for the show, as well as the Andy Fry Show. I'm joined by Sue Thomas, who in just a couple of minutes will have Sue's news. The final one of 2024.
Oh, that's right. I just can't seem to comprehend that it's New Year's Eve.
I feel like it always kind of hits you, and maybe it is that if Christmas and New Year's weren't so close together, you would kind of process that the end of the year is really here a little bit more, but you spend a whole at least month, some people more, focusing so much on getting to Christmas, and then all of a sudden you're kind of hit with like 3 days to realize that it's the end of the year. Maybe that's a fair reason.
No, I get that. I also have really enjoyed having every Wednesday off for 2 weeks. You know, those of us who have gone for work, then we suddenly get a middle of the week off. It's kind of nice.
It is a little bit nice. It kind of, you know, you kind of approach the week, at least I do, Sue, is like, okay, you know, you get to Wednesday, you're halfway there, and then you get to Thursday, and you're like, okay, it's Friday Eve. You know what I think is a funny thing? Abby, the former producer of the show, did she ever tell you she used to hate Thursdays?
Yeah, and that really freaked me out. Because I like a Thursday.
I do too. It kind of feels like, you know, you're still obviously, you know, taking it just as seriously, but the light is at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, but it's just funny how everybody looks at it differently.
Right. Right. That's a good point. And we love Abby and we miss her and we hope that all is well for her. But she was wrong about her Thursdays. Me and Sue
yes,
Sue and
was.
I Sue and I
okay,
agree
now,
on that.
This is an odd question, but everybody, I assume, has the days of the week, when you think of the days of the week, you have it pictured in your mind, mm-hmm. do you not?
Yes.
And I assume that everybody has a different way of doing that. How do you picture them? Like mine are an oval. On the left side of the oval are Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then that's kind of in the lighter shade. And then in a darker shade is Saturday at the bottom. And then at the top is Sunday. How are yours?
Oh, interesting. So you're talking about like how you view like what?
Yeah, in your mind, when someone says Wednesday, you picture it somehow.
Yeah. So in my mind, and maybe this isn't answering it as good as you were hoping, but this is kind of how I approach it. It's like if you can get to Wednesday, my mindset is always, you know, we have church on Wednesday night, and I always look forward to that. If you can get through those early days of the week, then you're kind of on the way back down from there.
Yes.
Thursday and Friday just seem a little bit more chill. You're holding on to like, okay, you're right there. But having something in the middle of the week, I try to make that church for me on Wednesday nights. Now, the last couple of weeks, right, that thing that we've been looking forward to is having a whole day off. So we'll have to get back to like, okay, you get back to having that... be looking forward to church on Wednesdays. That's kind of how I put it. It's not necessarily a picture.
You don't have
but
it
it's like,
in your head as a how it looks?
Not
That's
really.
To me.
Not really. I mean, I guess you always, I mean, those old Geico commercials, you know, the hump day commercials, you get to the hump and then you're on the way back down. So like maybe like a big hill and you're climbing up it, and then you get to Wednesday, and you're slowly
and you go back
down.
Down.
And then you're just kind of chilling Friday and Saturday. Because Friday, to me, even working on Friday, still seems like a weekend day to me. Even though sometimes with the roundtables, they end up being the busiest days of the week. Part of it's you know, we got two more hours, and you know, I tend to be a little bit more, you might think this is interesting. As I'm doing my wrap-up work after the show on Fridays, sometimes I'll turn on my phone, like I'll turn on Netflix or something, because I'm like, okay, we made it through the week. I'll watch something as I'm working, and sometimes that keeps me here longer, but in my mind, I'm just kind of like, I can be a little more lackadaisical now that the weekend's over. So, like I said, some people might think that's backwards, because you're like, why the heck wouldn't you just try to get out of there quicker? But after a whole week of working with Mark Reardon, sometimes you're just beat up and you're gassed, Sue.
I get it. I totally get it.
Sue, do you have any plans here for New Year's Eve tonight?
No, I think here's what I think we're going to do. Watch the Great British Bake Show.
Ooh.
We've made it about partway through. That's one of our favorites. We'll pop some popcorn. I guarantee you I will not make it to midnight. I get up in the fours.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. But you don't have to be up tomorrow, do you?
Nope. Okay. So it's all good. What about you?
So I think that my wife and her family, they leave tomorrow, but we're going to try this new restaurant she sent me earlier. Let's see. What is it called? Twisted Tavern?
Oh, that's interesting.
It's in St. Peter's.
There. Oh,
and I know absolutely nothing about it, but it has a cool name, so at least we have that going for us. And then one of my good friends, actually Brandon, who we had on the show yesterday, is hosting some of us for a New Year's Eve party. So we're going to stop by there, and then we'll go back home, and we'll hang out with the in-laws. And that'll be my evening. But I tell you what, so you say you don't remember the last time you were up till midnight. I don't remember the last time I went to bed before midnight.
Well, that's just kind of how it is hours-wise.
Yeah, you know, at some point, I'm sure that'll flip, but I hope at no point in my life am I having to get up and work at 4 a.m. I've done enough of that as a part-timer, mixing
Fair
in
enough.
Doing Mark Cox on the occasion. Okay, time for some Suze News, last one of the year.
Yep.
Here we go.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Well, we're going to start with today is the national day. Now, yesterday we missed it. It was Bacon Day.
Ooh.
And just think about that for a minute. Some sizzling bacon. Maybe you can have some tomorrow morning. When I was writing that down, I thought, dang it, do I have time to get to the store and get some for tomorrow? But I don't, I guess so, but then you'll have to deal with the people. Today, however, is National No Interruptions Day. Now, you look it up, and it turns out that is because if you have any work to get done before the end of the year, you want no interruptions while that happens today. And National Make Up Your Mind Day, which is probably a good thing for all of us. Ah, maybe it's about New Year's resolutions. What are you going to do? Make up your mind and start it tomorrow.
I'm kind of wondering what kind of people out there put stuff off and like that you have to do deadline-wise until New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve. I don't know.
I feel like deadline in my mind, that kind of stuff, is like before Christmas break, because in my mind I want to try to do the least amount of work as possible in that time between Christmas and New Year's.
Understandable, but I think sometimes it just gets away from you. I guess it depends on what all you have on your plate.
I guess that's fair.
Yeah, since we didn't talk about it yesterday, I feel like we should mention it today. And of course we all realize that President Jimmy Carter passed away yesterday. The first president to live to 100.
Wow.
And, of course, he's in my lifetime. I mean, I could not vote for him or anything, but I remember it as a little kid because they made such a big deal out of him being a peanut farmer from Georgia, but also a U.S. naval officer who became a state senator in 1963. Then he became governor and he beat Gerald Ford, not by a lot, in 1976. Now, in 1976, Ethan, everything was painted red, white, and blue.
Mm-hmm,
now, I mean, even if you would drive down the road and see that the dogs pee on?
The dogs pee on?
It's a fire thing.
Fire hydrant.
The fire hydrants were red, white, and blue. Everything was red, white, and blue. So anything from 1976 kind of sticks out to me, and I think that's why I remember him. But then he lost to Reagan in 1980. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2002. But also, Linda Lavin passed away yesterday. Do you know who she is?
I do not know who that is.
She was an actress, really great. And most people my age remember her from the sitcom Alice.
Okay.
But she was also a voice of Helen Kellerman on Bob's Burgers. You know I love me the Bob's Burgers.
Oh, yeah.
And she did a couple episodes of Mom as the mother of Violet's boyfriend. A lot of TV appearances. She was great on Broadway. In fact, when she got into her 70s, she was nominated for a Tony in The Lions.
Really?
She really had kind of a resurgence in her 70s. But anybody else who's of my era would remember her from Alice and Kiss My Grits. That wasn't her line, but that was a part of the show.
So quickly, I have to mention real quick, I didn't get a chance to there, but when you were mentioning Jimmy Carter, I love that the first thing that, as far as the fire hydrants goes, the first thing to try to, you know, help me think of what they were, you said dogs pee on.
Now, I can't.
You know, yeah. What about, you know, I mean, where water comes from, where firemen use it? No, where dogs pee on.
That's what dogs pee on. They have just repainted them in my neighborhood, and both of my dogs stop and pee on. What is happening?
But that is pretty funny about I did not know that 1976
yes.
about everything. That's really cool, everything being...
It was awesome.
Now, you know what? I wonder, because don't we have a... we have another anniversary coming up here, 76. So, well, I guess next 2026 will be, what, 200 and... How many? 50 years?
Well, I don't know. Don't make me do math. But yes, it's coming.
250 years. So I know Trump, right after he won, announced that they were going to do a very big sort of celebration for 250 years. So I wonder if we'll get some of that patriotic stuff back.
26.
And then,
wouldn't that be? Yeah.
That would
be
cool.
It's going to be cool. And I would assume we would.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the world exists a photo. Everybody did, like my mother and I, for some reason, somebody had sewn us red, white, and blue, like 1700s outfits, you know, with the hat, the long skirt.
Yes.
I'll try to find that. I mean, everything.
Okay,
was
and
about
I,
the bicentennial.
I need you to do one more thing before me. You're gonna think I'm a little bit odd for this, but I'm gonna ask you to mention that it's National Bacon Day one more time here.
It is National Bacon Day.
That has to be one of the best sounds in the world.
Agreed.
And it wasn't hard to find this. I typed in bacon with an S, and it popped up 4 hours of bacon sizzling on YouTube. So if you sometimes people fall asleep to the ocean, sometimes people fall asleep to the sound of rain. If you need to fall asleep to the sound of bacon sizzling, then YouTube has you covered.
I love this. YouTube does everything.
Amen to that.
We've talked about this before. The reason that Netflix and Amazon want a piece of live sports, that's why they're streaming things, is because it's one of the few things people want to watch live. Well, they've got the list of the 100 most watched primetime broadcasts of 2024 out, and the large part of them were sports, like 75 out of the 100. We had the Summer Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There were about 45 NFL games. There was a World Series, some NBA Finals. Oh, and the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship.
Ah, yes, Caitlin
remember
Clark,
that?
Yep.
However, the number one watched, you know, now this is just broadcast. I should say telecast.
Can I guess?
Yes.
I'm going to guess the coverage of President Trump getting shot.
Oh, that's interesting. No, it was the presidential debate.
That's another good one.
On September 10th. But number two, Ethan, was the Super Bowl. So
okay. Oh, wow.
This
so
is
that,
why.
That's I'm surprised that the debate beat that.
I know. I was, too. But this is why Netflix, because we keep hearing, oh, they're picking up, Netflix is picking up more sports, Amazon. One of them had picked up FIFA, the World Cup for the women. And that's why. Sorry, crowd.
Yeah.
But that's why. It's because so many people want to watch this stuff. It's the only thing that counts that you have to see live, right? Anything else you can stream. But sports.
Yeah, I'm trying to think even. I mean, people don't really watch the news as much. It used to be. Even when I was a kid, I mean, the news was on in the mornings. I mean, sometimes I guess if the weather is really bad, the Weather Channel. But I'm trying to think of stuff outside of sports that people watch live now, and I'm struggling to come up with anything really.
Exactly, it's got to be sports or because you're right. We've got the weather probably on the phone, but you're right. I will still tune in if it's severe. Okay, here's our nice story of the day. There was a family in Florida. They've got a 4-year-old German Shepherd named Athena. And somehow she got out on December the 15th. They can't find her. And they are just looking everywhere. They've got the neighbors looking. She's posted on social media and, you know, people from different towns, Jacksonville, all letting her know, oh, we saw a dog. Oh, we didn't see a dog. But no sign of the dog.
Oh, man.
So the family goes to bed on Christmas Eve. And the kids are a little upset, but, you know, it's Christmas Eve. And about 2:30 in the morning, they've got one of the Ring doorbells. The doorbell rings, and it's the dog herself.
Oh, my goodness.
Who, because she is a German Shepherd and tall enough and smart enough, has come back home and actually rang the doorbell at 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
The mom said she checked her phone and saw the dog's face staring at her. So she got up and went downstairs, let the dog in, and she was hoping it wouldn't wake the kids, but of course it did because everybody's all excited.
Uh-huh.
And Athena the dog let herself home and rang the doorbell on Christmas Eve.
9 days.
Right?
That's
Where
a long
she?
Time.
And by the way, side note, she did not have a chip. She wasn't chipped, and the family said, you know, the first thing we're doing in the new year is going out and getting her chipped. Because if someone would have found her, they could have just scanned that, called them, and it would have been better.
You know, I wonder how expensive it is to get that done. Because
it's not.
Really? It sounds like something that would be.
I know, but it's not cost prohibitive. I can't remember, but both of mine have it, which means they couldn't have been that much, Ethan.
Well, it seems like a very common sense thing to do that.
Yeah.
In today's day and age, I mean, if you have the technology and it's not that expensive, why not do it? Because, I mean, what are the odds of it happening? Probably not very high, but what you're risking is, you know, a lot of sadness.
Right, exactly. It was really sweet that she was able to make it back by then. All right, and finally in Sue's news, we have today's random fact. I just found this interesting. McDonald's feeds, there are so many McDonald's in the world, that McDonald's feeds 70 million people per day.
Holy
which
moly.
Is just under 1% of the world's population.
Wow.
What?
That is insane.
Oh,
70 million a day.
Yes. Yes.
I wonder how many of those, like, I guess I'm trying to think of how I'd ask this. How many of those people are repeats like daily? How many
right.
of those people that are getting it, like, you know, of the 70 million, how many of them, how many times do they get it per year, kind of thing, you know? And
yeah,
some people
mm-hmm.
I'm sure are getting it just about every single day. You know, there's other people's, it's like myself, where it's once a couple of times a year. I don't
right.
know. The McDonald's numbers, you could really get interesting with some of those, I'm sure, because
yeah,
they're such big numbers.
For sure.
Well,
and that's it for Sue's news.
Well, Sue, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. You finished the year on a strong note, just like you started. And we look forward to plenty more wonderful Sue's news in the upcoming year. A couple more best of segments when we return. Maureen Ferguson, and then that'll get followed by John Morosky. You are listening to the final Mark Rudin Show of 2024. Welcome back to the Mark Rudin Show on 97.1 FM Talk. I am Ethan Hannaford, hosting Best Of segments on this lovely New Year's Eve. Mark will be back on January 2nd. Tomorrow we will have a fully produced New Year's Day Best Of show. Just a little quick update here. The Winter Classic is underway, and just under 2 minutes in, the Blues are already up 1-0. And a congratulations to Cam Fowler, the Blues' newest defenseman, who they acquired just a few weeks ago in a trade with the Anaheim Ducks, just scored in his 1,000th career NHL game to give the Blues a 1-0 lead. So congratulations to Cam Fowler. What a memorable game to be playing your 1,000th in the Winter Classic. I believe it's his first Winter Classic as well. So very cool little thing right there. So the Best Of segments continue. Maureen Ferguson, a senior fellow with the Catholic Association, joined Mark back in August to discuss the future of cell phones, their concerns with children being hooked on electronics, and what some of those effects could be and are already.
Maureen Ferguson is with us this afternoon. She is a senior fellow with the Catholic Association, wrote about some of the tech stuff that is invading, you know, if you have kids, you know, it's really been invasive with kids and in the classroom in particular. And Maureen, first of all, let me just ask you how you are this afternoon. How are you doing? Thanks for coming back.
I'm doing great, and I'm so happy to be talking with you today about this really important topic that I feel so passionate about. As a mother especially, I feel very passionate about this topic.
Maureen, I am terrified because I have two kids that are out of the house, one of whom is about to make me a grandfather in a few weeks, but I have a little 9.5-year-old. And, you know, mom and dad are busy, and unfortunately she's on electronics too much, but I'm just terrified by what the future holds. And you wrote about this sort of in connection with, and I've seen Jonathan Haidt interviewed about his book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And this is true, and parents need to know this, but if we're being honest, a lot of us are like, okay, go ahead and take your screen time because we need a life too. So it's a complicated yet terrifying situation, isn't it?
Yes. So this is my advice to parents. Number one, read this book, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, because, I mean, if you're a parent in today's world, you really just need to be aware of how significant the impact of smartphones and social media is on your kids. And the subtitle of this book is The Great Rewiring, how the minds of an entire generation of children are being rewired by smartphone use and social media. So number one, parents really need to educate themselves. And this is a totally research-based book, but it's a very easy read, though. It's not like super dense or anything. And this guy, Jonathan Haidt, he's an NYU social psychologist. So he backs up all the research, and he also makes some good recommendations. But so number one, that's what I think all parents listening should do. Read this book called The Anxious Generation. But number two, and this is what I think parents are missing. I've now raised five kids. I have one teenager left, but I've just kind of gone through this with all of my teenagers. And this is what I think parents miss. It's actually easier to say no than it is to kind of cave in, say yes, deal with the constant negotiation. Like, then you're the policeman. Once you cave in, then you've got to monitor it. And trust me, it is impossible to properly monitor this technology. All the different platforms, apps, I mean, we parents, there's just no way we can keep up on it. The parental controls don't work, or the kids know a way around them. It's literally easier to just say no and help your kids to develop an in-person social life. Your kids will be happier, they'll be healthier, and they'll actually be much easier to raise. So, it's much more difficult to raise kids when they get sucked down these rabbit holes on social media.
I don't challenge any of what you said. In fact, I think it's all true. I rate everything that you said is true. But and maybe this is a reflection of my own terrible parenting, Maureen, but let's face it, most parents are not willing to make that tough call, are they?
Well, no, and this is why it's totally understandable, because you don't want your kid to be the only one.
Right.
Because that would be kind of unfair to your kid, because then they really would be kind of left out of their social life. So one of the things that Jonathan Haidt talks about in this book, The Anxious Generation, is that it's a collective problem. If all the kids are communicating through social media, well, that's a collective problem. So what he says the solution is, you need collective action amongst the parents. And the Surgeon General, the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, so he's the top doctor. He has kids himself. He also says the exact same thing, that you as a parent need to get together with your kids' friends' parents. So you need to kind of have a little collusion, a little parental collusion here, and say, hey, listen, let's just give our kids like a dumb phone. Let's give them a basic phone so then they can call and text each other. They can be in touch. And there's a growing market of these phones now, the basic phones. There's the pinwheel, there's the Gab, there's the light phone. There's a whole new market of these phones that don't have the internet access and the social media apps that suck your kids into very dark places. So kids can have a light phone, a dumb phone, you know, some version of that. So what parents are doing, getting together with other parents in a friend group or in a school group. We're currently doing this with my 13-year-old daughter's, you know, eighth grade class. We, the moms, we get together for coffee. We get together for a glass of wine, and we say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Let's give them a dumb phone until maybe junior year. And then maybe we'll let them have a smartphone so we can teach them how to use it. But let's keep all of these girls in this friend group, we're all keeping them off social media.
Yeah, I love that.
So that that's a collective solution. And then that group of girls, they see the benefits of an in-person friendship and an in-person social life. And they're not so interested in sort of the online, you know, life and drama that some of their friends are getting sucked into. They're other, you know, kind of beyond their immediate friends.
Maureen Ferguson is here. She's a senior fellow with the Catholic Association, wrote about this in Jonathan Haidt's book. Now, one of the things, I've seen some encouraging things out there from some school districts, and I can't remember if it was Los Angeles or somewhere else, but why is it so difficult for schools not to put the hammer down? Because I think a lot of parents are ready to say, yes, we need to do this and get the phones out of these kids at the very least when they're in school during the day.
Yeah, so you know what? It's actually teachers who were first to notice the really, really bad effects on kids' brains of the smartphone and social media. And teachers know that they're no match for the kid's phone under the desk, right? Kids are scrolling, they're checking the sports scores, they're watching TikTok videos, they're getting sucked down all kinds of rabbit holes, right? During the school day when they're supposed to be learning. So teachers were first to notice the plummeting test scores, the short-circuited attention spans. You know, even a super dynamic teacher in the front of a classroom is no match for a TikTok video, you know, with the teenager getting sucked in. So many schools now are going phone-free. The chancellor of the largest district in the United States, the chancellor of the New York City schools, he read this book, Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, and he said, okay, by the fall, we're all going phone free. Los Angeles is doing the same. A lot of the big school districts are doing the same, going phone free. And if your kid is going back to school this fall, I mean, we're in back to school season, and your child's school is not phone free, you should pick up the phone and call the principal, call the head of school and say, we've got to hang together as adults to protect our kids from having they're literally having their brains rewired. And it's documented really well in this book.
Well, and it's not only that, but, you know, that's bad enough. And I think that we probably should have taken some of these steps earlier. But then it's exacerbated by everything that happened with the pandemic, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. It habituated kids to screens. Absolutely. The pandemic definitely exacerbated all of this. And you know, one thing is we parents also kind of have to be okay with not being able to be in touch with our kids constantly. You know, the front desk at the school has a landline. The kids can always call us, you know, or if there's a real problem, the teacher will call us. Somebody from school will call us. But
absolutely. That always school, I don't get why parents think that that's an issue, because they'd absolutely be able to get a hold of, you know, parents.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another point that Jonathan Haidt makes in this book is, so he says that children now, he calls it a phone-based childhood, and that's absolutely what it is. Kids are growing up with a phone-based childhood. He says this is incompatible with human development, because as kids have gotten more sucked into their phones, where there's no meaningful guardrails online for kids, there's so much danger out there, right? Well, in the meantime, in real life, there's this culture of safetyism, right? Like the helicopter parent. So kids don't have the freedom in real life to, like, whatever, walk to the mall with their friends or play at the park by themselves.
Which is baffling, right?
Yes. So kids are not learning. They're not able to hang out with their friends in unsupervised settings. And when kids are kind of having to hang out on their own, like just the backyard play, the neighborhood play, the outdoor play, that's when kids learn, like, risk assessment.
All it's those things.
When
absolutely.
They learn problem yep. solving. It's when they learn relationship negotiation. So, like, we were talking about parents needing to let go of their kids a little bit. And, you know, because parents want to be in touch. So my 13-year-old was taking the bus. We had a miscommunication about which bus she was taking, the early bus, the late bus. So my daughter had like 2 hours without me. You know, she doesn't have a phone, so she couldn't just call me. well, you know what? She had to solve a problem. She walked up to the boys' school, which was right up the street. She eventually got the landline. She called me. I was still like 45 minutes away. So she
was able to communicate. Yeah, look, my daughter and I were having a conversation this morning because she had sort of, we had given her, she had committed our phone numbers to memory and then had forgotten about them more recently. And she was going to a couple of camps where there was thankfully no electronics and she could recite both numbers now. So there's a way to get a hold of parents. Maureen, this is such a great topic and I want to go on, but I'm up against the clock. I've heard a lot about Jonathan's book. I have not read it. I need to do it myself. But thank you so much for writing about it and coming on here this afternoon.
Great. Good to talk to you.
All right. Take care. I found this in Real Clear Investigations a couple of weeks ago, and some other people have written in the aftermath of John Murawski's investigation about civics. It seems like civics is making a comeback in higher education. Now, when I hear that, I'm a little nervous, but maybe we can turn some of this around with the left-wing indoctrination. John Murawski is with us this afternoon. Hi, John. How are you? Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So this is, now let's define civics first and foremost, because we're not talking about high school here. You're kind of focusing on higher education, right?
Right. So civics in higher ed may include some of those elements that you think about, like, you know, branches of government and the history of the country. But it dwells much more into the underlying intellectual ideas that give rise to the institutions and the debates of the time. So you're reading the Federalist Papers, you're reading John Locke, you're reading John Stuart Mill, you're reading, you know, basically philosophers and political philosophers and moral philosophers and related works, rather than just, you know, blackboard lessons about branches of government.
I guess, and so, yeah. I guess I might say, you know, it's been a little while since I've been in college. I'm like, gosh, I didn't know all of that went away.
Well, you know, it never completely goes away. But it recedes into, you know, hidden corners of the universe. So if you, you know, if you go to the right college, if you find the right professor, you can take these kinds of classes, but they're not mandatory. They're not widespread. They're not universal. And so you have to work to find them. There are certain places dedicated just for the proliferation of these ideas, like, for example, Hillsdale College, which is a private university, takes no government funding. And that's all they do. But they're not really integrated into a university. So you have basically, you know, Hillsdale College is largely, you know, will be largely conservative Christian students. So if you're, you know, if you're studying radical feminism, you're not going to be exposed to what's at Hillsdale College unless you take a, you know, a long bicycle ride to get over there. Whereas imagine placing these civic centers, they're not, I wouldn't consider them to be replicas of Hillsdale College, although some of them might come closer to being like Hillsdale College than others. But for example, what you have at, you know, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that is much more, that's much more ecumenical than Hillsdale College. You have, you know, contemporary debates about pronouns, transgender politics, yeah, that kind of stuff, critical race theory, reparations. There's different emphases at different different programs. Some of them are more focused on like economic liberty and free markets, but some of them are much more, well, just what you would think when you took a humanities class 20, 30, 40 years ago, which is just the great books, the great ideas and things like that.
So you in your reporting at Real Clear, you said some warn against the natural temptation to hire faculty based on political beliefs and wage warfare against the woke machine and thereby risk becoming right wing echo chambers and alienating professors and students. The quote you have is from a Harvard historian who says the solution to politicization on the left is not politicization from the right. And I would agree with that. However, here's where I would come down. Let's talk about the faculty that is hired that is trusted with the civics education. And I guess my question would be, can they be trusted with the civics education?
Well, I think it's going to vary from program to program and from university to university and, dean to dean. And so some of these civics programs might end up looking a lot like Hillsdale College, basically kind of like Republican Party recruiting operations and training for, you know, basically for street level or, you know, or regulatory, legal and political engagement at a political level. But some of them, I think, are going to preserve the spirit of, intellectual independence. And there'll be a variety. I think in the same way that you can go to some English literature departments and study something that resembles literature.
Right.
And other linguistic departments is essentially will be, you know, you'll be essentially involved in a human rights tribunal prosecuting texts for crimes against humanity or for legitimizing crimes against humanity. So there's a variety of English departments. There's a variety, you know, math departments, business departments differ. Some of them are, you know, economics departments. Some of them are liberal. Some of them are conservative. You know, University of Chicago economics is known as conservative. I think Yale, Harvard, probably known as liberal. So and so I think you have that. You just have the natural variation that you have in academia already.
But, John, are the universities, like you focus a lot on North Carolina, is this coming from a demand for that type of education from the students? Is it coming from a different place? What's the motivation for it?
Yeah. I mean, the motivation for it is that the modern academy has been essentially hijacked, or the humanities and the social sciences have been hijacked by professors who we would call them, you know, we could call them woke, or we could call them post-structuralist, or we could call them postmodernist, but they're not really, they're largely focused on critique, critiquing systems of power. And critiquing systems of power is not critiquing themselves. It's critiquing conservative politics or traditional or just Western, you know, the Western civilization, patriarchy, things like that. So they are in the business of critique, and there isn't really a vibrant tradition of studying Western literature, Western civilization from a non-hostile perspective, but from a more sympathetic perspective.
Yeah.
Now, you have to remember, though, that Western civilization is not a singular narrative. It is largely a very embittered debates between philosophers, politicians, writers, poets, artists on what it means. You have to see it as a family squabble, to the point of people being disowned and estranged from each other. And the postmodernist tradition, or this, you know, critique tradition, including Marxism, is kind of part of the Western tradition. So the question really I think you're asking is, to what extent can you do Western civilization, and how would you incorporate Michel Foucault and, you know, Judith Butler, the queer theorist, and Karl Marx and a long tradition of Marxist philosophy into the Western tradition, because they are a part of the Western tradition in their own way. So the question is, are you conceiving of the Western tradition by exempting entire branches of intellectual and philosophical inquiry, or can you incorporate them?
I understand, you know, with all of this in higher education, I think I've said before, you don't want to teach the 1619 Project, teach the 1619 Project. But where is the other perspective, right? There should be another perspective, and there doesn't seem to be any.
That is my gut feeling and my instinct as well. Is my suspicion is that much of what the reason you hear this word indoctrination, that students are indoctrinated into social justice ideology, because they are taught critical race theory and queer theory and post-colonialist theory as a kind of catechism. There isn't really a critique of it. The critique,
that's right.
They get to do the critique of the other side, but no one gets to do a critique of them. They are sort of inviolable and sacrosanct. So what I think would be fascinating is teach these subjects the way we teach Freud, or the way we teach Aristotle, or the way we teach Jung, or the way we teach, you know, any of a number of, you know, Wittgenstein. They're not taught as holy writ. They're not taught as gospel. They are critiqued, and we learn about, you know, Wittgenstein and his detractors, or Wittgenstein and his critics, modernity and its discontents, right? So we should also do Judith Butler, all the people who think Judith Butler is crazy. And we should also do Michel Foucault and all the people who think Michel Foucault has done a tremendous amount of damage. So that would be my preference, not to erase them from the historical record, but to pair them in a kind of dialectic with their critics.
I just don't know. Yeah, and I agree with you. I just don't know if you can have, like, could you have the modern day academia university professors handle both sides of that? I have, you know, every once in a while, well, quite often I have contributors to this show. My friend Scott Jennings comes to mind, who teach, you know, semesters at Harvard, and they'll do it with, Jennings is on the conservative side, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but they'll do it with someone else, you know, that was in the Obama administration or someone like that. So they're both teaching at the same time. And I think that could be very valuable. I mean, you got interesting exchanges, different perspectives. But you're not going to put two professors in a room for every class.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not on these campuses. I'm not in the classes. And I assume that some of this takes place to some degree. But I think that it's not a kind of living, vibrant tradition. I tend to think that it tends to be the exception. So
yeah, I think you're right.
The thing is that you're trying to get at, and I think that these critics get at, and I is, are we going to just have two, you know, two silos and two echo chambers living in parallel universes, or is there going to be any way to cross fertilize? And they do have, you know, the civic centers do more than teach courses. They do K through 12 teacher workshops, trainings, and courses, summer academies. They run high school essay contests. They have speaker series, lectures, conferences, roundtables, symposia. They have reading groups. So they do engage in a, you know, in the public arena,
right,
in the marketplace of ideas.
Get more at 971talk.com.